Accession number 18772, Reel 3.
Don Thomas Thompson, Reel 3.
148 Octu was a training camp, if you like, for the production of short service commission officers, and it was a typical wartime camp built on the top of an escarpment in a dense wood, and all the accommodation were Nissen huts and elephant shelters. And our primary task there was to give them basic training in weapon training and drill. And to make certain that when they went for driving lessons or motorcycle lessons, we would march them to the MT sheds and hand them over to the instructors. Not a very exciting episode, but what I did find interesting there was the fact that there were not only British cadets, but also cadets from all over the world, particularly the Middle East, who found the British way of life, if you like, I suppose, a little intriguing. Anyway, after about 5 months, 148 Octu was disbanded. So then we went back to a holding battalion at Beverley, where we spent about 3 or 4 weeks until the War Office decided what to do with us. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention there was I got my second stripe while I was down at Rootham, so I went back to Beverley and ultimately back to Lincoln as a corporal, much to my delight. I thought all those long months of 29th Training Battalion are finally paying off. From Lincoln, I was called into the company office one morning, and the sergeant major said, "Right, I've got a job for you." He said, "We've got some Danes coming in next week." I said, "Danes, sir?" "Yes," he said, "you know, people from Denmark." So I said, "Yes, sir." He says, "We have got a platoon of Danish national servicemen coming in," he says, "and we are going to train them." He says, "And you are going to be in charge of them." So I said, "I don't speak Danish, sir." He said, "Of course you bloody well don't," he said, "but the interpreter speaks English." So I said, "You mean to tell me that everything I say to them is going to be interpreted?" He says, "Yes." He says, "You catch on very, very quickly." He says, "Right. Monday morning," he says, "come back with full instructions." So after breakfast, I wait 30 hours. Monday morning, I went to company office and got a 1,500 weight truck and 2 or 3 tonners. And we went down to Lincoln Station to meet my Danes. There were about 18 of them. There was a corporal, 2 lance corporals, and the rest were private soldiers. And I was absolutely amazed at the discipline of those lads. They got off the train and they immediately fell into 3 ranks with no words of command, and the 2 lance corporals bouncing up and down, making certain they were properly dressed. The corporal came across, this only time in my life I've ever been saluted, and introduced himself as Corporal. Oh, I can't attempt to pronounce his name, but he was the interpreter. He spoke quite good English. And again, to cut a very, very long story short, every single word of command on weapon training, on drill and any other lectures, I had to pause about every 5 seconds for the interpreter to pass it across to the other. The 2 lance corporals and the private soldier had a brief understanding of English, but not enough to understand, you know, when I was talking about the brain gun or the rifle or dual command, something to understand what was going on. On the drill ground, we didn't have much problem because the interpreter didn't need to transfer, you know, squad, shun, by the left, quick march. They understood the basics. They understood about turn, left turn, right turn, order, arm, shoulder. They understood the basics. And honestly, it was a most rewarding episode, I think, in my career when those lads successfully passed out at the end of 3 months. I felt absolutely delighted. We had a ram sammy in one of the local pubs in Lincoln. At the end of the course, there was myself and two of my lance corporals who've seen them through, and I'm not kidding you, those lads could drink and drink and drink and drink. And all credit to them, at the end of the night, when they'd each consumed, I would think, the equivalent of about 10 or 12 pints of bitter, they all got out, fell in ranks, in three ranks, outside the pub, and marched back up New Road, Lincoln, Burton Road, singing one of their Danish national songs at the top of the voice. You know, I sort of walked behind them, trying to indicate to the local population, you know, they had nothing to do with me. But honestly, they were the nicest set of people, I think, that I've ever come across. Anyway, my experiences with the Danish platoon at New Barracks. From then on, the Midland Brigade Training Centre was formed at Strensel. Because the War Office at that time were grouping all home infantry regiments into brigades. And each brigade, not a strictly three-division brigade, but what War Office were doing was to group all home infantry regiments into home brigades. And what it meant was that within the brigade, personnel could do a cap badge transfer from one regiment to another. For example, we were the Midland Brigade, and we consisted of the Lincolnshire Regiment, the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, Sherwood Foresters, and the Royal Leicestershire Regiment. So that meant that within the Midland Brigade, I could personally do a cap badge transfer to any of the other three regiments. The Midland Brigade Training Centre was then set up at Strensel, and most of us who were on the semi-permanent staff at Lincoln were transferred to Strensel to set up the Brigade Training Centre. So off to Strensel we went, and that must have been about, I think we're in about 1947 now. I'd only been there a few weeks when I got my third stripe and I entered the sergeant's mess for the very, very first time. I'd only been a sergeant about 7 weeks, and then one Sunday evening when I was I'd been out in York on the Sunday afternoon, I came back and looked on company orders, and much to my horror, a week on the following Monday, I was due to go down to the Guards Depot at Caterham on a drill course. Well, I think it's about the most miserable 6 weeks I have ever spent in all my life. The Guards Depot at Caterham. If you have never been through the gates of the Guards Depot at Caterham on a drill course, then believe you me, you just haven't lived. It was sheer hell. On parade at 08:15 on Monday morning after drill, and then double quick march from outside the barrack block onto the drill square. Now, bearing in mind that we were all sergeants, WO1s and WO2s, and we were treated exactly as the recruits were treated, as though we knew absolutely nothing about anything. Sergeant McQueen of the Irish Guards was our platoon sergeant, and he was a devil beyond reincarnation. He was absolutely brutal. But at the end of the 6 weeks, you know, we could really appreciate what Sergeant McQueen, and if I may whisper the horrible word, RSM Britain, who was the RSM at the time, they taught us all that they knew themselves. The thing that really, really sticks in my mind, and I'm sure the Brigade and Guard wouldn't like me to say this, was that at the time, back in 1947, bearing in mind that most of the recruits into the Guards were conscripts, National Servicemen, they were treated with the most abominable cruelty, in inverted commas, that I've ever witnessed during the whole of my army career. They were hounded around from morning to night, never a moment's peace. We'd walk past the barrack blocks, you know, from our own barrack room to the sergeant's mess or out through the main gate, and the recruits would be sitting on their beds, polishing their boots, sitting bolt upright, and one of the platoon NCOs would be marching up and down, you know, barking regimental history questions at them. It was dreadful. Perhaps the most significant point that I remember about this drill course was one day when a warrant officer, one in the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, who was on our course, did something wrong. For life of me, I can't remember what he did. But the regimental sergeant major, Britton, walked onto the square and ordered him into the guard room under close arrest. So his rifle was taken from him. His bayonet was withdrawn, and he was double marched by two of the drill instructors into the guard room. Full stop. He was there for about 3 hours, and then he was released. So the significance of that was that on a drill course in the guards depot Caterham, you know, rank was of no consequence. However, we finally made it. We eventually passed out, much to the delight of Sergeant McQueen, who let us know in uncertain terms how proud of us he was. And then he was back to Stransel in the new year, so I'm back in 1948 now, aren't I? And then shortly afterwards, having established the Midland Brigade Training Centre, the Queen Elizabeth Barracks at Stransel was the depot of the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, and they were coming home from abroad and they wanted their depot back. So Midland Brigade Training Centre then moved from Stransel down to Budbrook Barracks, where those of us who were not members of the Royal Warwickshire Regiment were treated with the most complete and utter contempt by the Royal Warwickshire Depot RSM, a chap named Reggie Neal. I should never forget Reggie as long as I live. Because at that time, you see, we were still wearing our parent regiment cap badges. Because the ruling was at Stransel that we were a collective training centre. We were not a specific unit, like a battalion of Leicesters or Foresters. So we were allowed to retain our own shoulder flash and our own cap badges. So subsequently, those of us who went to Budbrook who were not wearing a Royal Warwickshire Regiment cap badge got a bit of a rough ride off our edge. He really made it very, very clear, you know, that he was a Royal Warwickshire man through and through. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, he made our lives a misery. Both in the sergeant's mess and on the drill square. For example, I was a platoon sergeant, and I had a corporal and two lance corporals of a primary training platoon. And if I went on the square with my platoon, I bet you a pound to a pinch of snuff that Mr. Neal would know that we were there, and he would come and stand on the edge of the square watching us, and then he would march across and let me know on no uncertain terms that he was taking over, and then he would put the recruits through their drill. Fortunately, hand on heart, you know, thanks to good old Sergeant McLaughlin at Blackdown, I felt that I was doing my job properly, and on numerous occasions Mr. Neal had to admit, you know, that as far as he was concerned, the drill was up to a satisfactory standard. Right, so where are we now? June, July 1948, the Royal Leicestershire Regiment's 1st Battalion began mobilising to go to Hong Kong. The Chinese communists were making rapid approaches down through China and were approaching the South Guangdong province, which was that part of mainland China opposite Hong Kong. Military history suggests that at the time the British government had no way of knowing the intentions of the Chinese communist armies because they had no direct contact with them. So they were concerned that when the Chinese communist armies reached the southern tip of South Guangdong province, which was opposite Hong Kong, that they were going to cross the Shum Shui River and occupy Hong Kong itself. So in order to counter this, the War Office decided to mobilise an infantry division, which was to be known as 40 Infantry Division, and a 3rd Marine Commando Brigade, and send them out to Hong Kong. And of course, with every military operation, there had to be an advance party. So the 1st Battalion Royal Leicestershire Regiment which was in occupation at its depot at Glen Parva Barracks, way below battalion strength, was ordered to mobilise. So the advance party of 1st Royal Leicesters left Glen Parva about July 48, followed shortly afterwards by the remainder of the battalion at Glen Parva. The battalion, of course, then needed to be brought up to strength. So quite a large number of us from Budbrook were mobilised to go out to join them in Hong Kong. And that's how I got out to Hong Kong with the 1st Battalion Royal Leicester Regiment. Now, because we were moving to a positive identifiable unit, and of course that meant the cap badge change, so I had to take off my Forester's cap badge and my Forester's shoulder flushes and put on the Royal Leicestershire Regiment badge and shoulder flushes. When we got to Hong Kong, I was posted to Seacombe, I think it was, as a platoon sergeant. And we went into a barracks, which were the only permanent barracks on the in the colony, which were at the time occupied by the Buffs. The Buffs were the garrison battalion in Hong Kong, and had been since the war ended in 1945. So they were more than overdue for a python, for home leave. They moved out of Woodfield Barracks, and we moved in. And we thought, hey, this is great, you know. Right in the middle of Hong Kong, halfway down Nathan Road, you know, buses going past the front gate of the barracks every few moments, you know. It was paradise. Until about 7 weeks, then the whole battalion was gone and pray one morning, and Colonel Colonel Field came out. They stood on the steps of the order room and broke the news to us that we were going to occupy positions up in the New Territories. So, on the train we got up to Fanling, got off the train, and the three tunnels were waiting there for us, and took us along this road which led to Sai Kung, about half a mile from the Chinese border. On the right of the road, there were the paddy fields, and then the Sim Chun River, and then China itself, South Kwang Tung province. We could see the oil installation. It was there was a small harbour there on the other side of the river. And what had happened was that the Royal Engineers and local employed personnel had been doing some preparatory work and had laid these concrete bases, which we found out, you know, were to be bases for our tents. The main buildings, orderly room, cookhouse, sergeant's mess, they were already formed with these, you know, Nissen huts and larger elephant shelters, I think they called them. So what we needed to do when we got there, of course, was to put up our own tents. So we set about putting the tents up. Overnight, until all the tents were up, we crashed down in the buildings that were already up, you know, and used those as temporary sleeping quarters. Eventually, we got all the tents up, and the battalion, you know, sort of came together, and we started to function as a unit. And then, just a little way beyond our camp, the ground rose slightly and then flattened out. And then there was further activity going on there, and eventually the 1st Battalion Argyll and Southern Highlanders joined us at Norwegian Farm. And then for months and months and months, we were subject to the wail of the bagpipes, because in Scottish regiments, you see, every bugle call is followed by the corresponding tune on the bagpipes. The only thing I really enjoyed was lying in bed at night, you know, under your mosquito net, in your tent, listening to the Argyll's bugler follow our bugle with last post, and hearing the piper playing the last post on the pipes. It was quite enchanting. It was a haunting melody, you know, but you could imagine, without seeing him, you could imagine the piper walking through the night, you know, playing his pipes. It was a wonderful experience. So there we were, settled down, duties in Hong Kong. Each battalion in turn was internal security battalion in turn, which meant you're on an hour standby to go down to Kowloon or Hong Kong, you know, to quell any disturbances. We did get involved in one disturbance. When would it be? Early 1949. Agitators were creating problems in Kowloon, and the police were dealing with an incident in Nathan Road, which included about 400 or 500 people being egged on by agitators. And we stood to. The first two companies went down to Kowloon. I went down because by then I transferred into the signal platoon, and I was sort of operating the base set with the second in command of the battalion. And we watched the police and our two companies deal with the crowds. Shots were fired. The police had a system whereby they issued a triple warning to the crowd to disperse. And then if the crowd did not disperse, then this large banner was unfurled, and written in English and Chinese, you know, you're ordered to disperse or we will open fire, or words to that effect, you know. Anyway, this banner was displayed, and I remember standing behind the two companies who were actually, you know, strung right across Nathan Road, because it's a dual carriageway, and there was a silence for about a few seconds, and then right from the back of the crowd, you know, we sort of hear this loud hailer in Chinese urging something or other, and then the crowd, you know, started to shout and wave sticks and banners, and then they started to come forward, you see. So then the police opened fire for a start, and then the senior police officer came up to the company commander of A company, I think it was, A&D were down there at the time, and we saw the front rank actually go down into the kneeling position. And they ordered three rounds, rapid fire over the heads. And he did the trick, dispersed them, you know, because I don't think the crowd really believed, you know, that we would open fire. But you know, that's what we were there for.
Any casualties?
No. There were one or two people actually hurt in the crowd themselves with the crush, but nobody shot. And then one of our other many functions, of course, was to maintain the positions on our side of the river overlooking the Xiangxi River. The main purpose there was to assist the police in preventing refugees from streaming across from China, because just along the river bank from where the positions ended, there was the police post of Fanling, which was the crossing point. The police there were working 24 hours a day, you know, trying to control the refugees coming through. What many of them were doing, of course, you see, they were slipping into the river and paddling across. And it was our function there, together with the other battalions, the other regiments who were lining the bank on their outposts, you know, to prevent illegal entry into the colony. We picked up a couple one night who landed, you know, a man and a youngish woman. They sort of come across on this, got a big bulk of timber. And the woman was sort of lying across it, and the man was, you know, sort of paddling behind it. And when they finally got on shore, one of our young officers, you know, I heard him say to his platoon sergeant, he said, "Well, if these poor devils, you know, go to this trouble," he said, "and as far as I'm concerned," he said, "they can damn well come in." The sergeant said, "No, sir, no, you're not allowed to say that." So unfortunately, we had to arrest them and hand them over to the police. We did on one occasion experience an air attack by nationalist aircraft on the oil fuel depot that was on the other side of the river. I forget the name of the small town, but it was an attack this one day, much to our complete not a surprise, you know. So what on earth's going on? You know, we heard this, and then we saw the small bomb, you know, drop from beneath the aircraft, and it hit the oil tanks, you know, and poof, lot went up. Because so we were only half a mile over the paddy fields from the river, so we were quite close to the small town. But apart from that, you know, life was normal in infantry battalion. We did our training, we did our exercises, we suffered the sticky heat, we suffered the typhoons, we suffered the monsoons. I always remember at the back of the camp at Norwegian Farm, which we shared with the Argonauts and the Highlanders, there was this high ground which rose up. And along the bottom of this high ground, the Royal Engineers had dug out a monsoon ditch. Roughly would have been about, I think, 6 foot wide and about 4 foot deep, and it was intended to take the water away from the camp, the gushing down the hillside. Well, one Sunday morning, we woke up about 5:30, and the rain was absolutely thumping down on our tents as hard as it could. It woke us up, and about 4 hours later, the monsoon ditch actually overflowed. Now, if you could imagine the size of that ditch, 6 foot by 4 foot by about, 600 yards, because it skirted the whole perimeter of the camp. And it filled to the point where it overflowed. Our tents were flooded, the sergeant's mess was flooded, you know. And it took about all 3-4 days to dry out. But the monsoon rain was such, you know, that I remember going on one occasion, actually standing outside the tent, you know, and having a shower in the rain. It was so heavy. Go outside the tent, get soaked, come in, soap yourself, and then go outside again and let the rain wash it off. But the sticky heat was quite prolific. Mosquitoes and horrible hardback flying beetles. We'd have the sort of hand-powered gas lamps, you know, inside the tents for light, because there's no electricity in the tents. And these damn things would come in from outside, you know, and fly around the glass, you know, banging into them. And then the mosquito, you know, of course you had to put your mosquito nets down. If you didn't, you know, bzzz, drive you mad. Humidity was in Hong Kong was up to about sometimes 90-95%, and at night, you know, it was really, really was sticky. You'd lie on your bed there beneath your mosquito net, and the sweat would just pour out from you. Yeah, and you'd wake up in the small hours of the morning. Your pillow was soaked. You know, your mattress was soaked. And then, of course, there came the memorable occasion early in July 1950. When the whole battalion was called on parade on the volleyball pitch, and the CO, by that time being replaced by Colonel Hutchinson, broke the news. We knew the war in Korea had started. The Colonel broke the news to us, and what he said was that the 1st Battalion Argonne Southern Highlanders and the 1st Battalion Middlesex Regiment, who formed 27 Brigade with us, were being dispatched to Korea in order to supplement the American 24th Infantry Division, which was moving across from Japan. What the Colonel was looking for was volunteers from the regiment to make up the deficiencies in the Argylls and the Middlesex Regiment, because we were all under strength. We were about 80 or 90 personnel short of full battalion operational strength. Okay. And, within the signal platoon, we had a platoon of 45 strong. Six of our members actually volunteered to go up with the Argylls, which they eventually did. Anyway, again, to cut a very long story short, our six platoon members came back, told us all about the war in Korea, and then, of course, the speculation was, when would we be going? Well, the blow came when would it be? I think it was about August 1951.